10 minutes after 8, the Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I suspect that many of you are well acquainted with the amazing film Raiders of the Lost Ark. What you are almost certainly not aware of is sort of a real-life story that has at least some parallels to Raiders of the Lost Ark. And it's an incredible story and a largely untold story finally revealed to the world in a brand new book called True Raiders, the untold story of the 1909 expedition to find the legendary Ark of the Covenant. The book is by Brad Ricca, with whom I had the great pleasure of speaking previously about a really interesting book of his called Olive the Lionheart. He is also author of Mrs. Sherlock Holmes and Superboys. And this latest book, published by St. Martin's Press, has already attracted a great deal of attention. It is absolutely fascinating. And again, it's titled True Raiders, the untold story of the 1909 expedition to find the legendary Ark of the Covenant. Brad Ricca, we welcome you back to the Morning Show.
Greg, so nice to talk to you again.
And I have really enjoyed this so thoroughly. One of the things I want to ask you about is something that you say in the notes. You say, rather than a history, this is a history of the story. It's a really interesting distinction to make, and I think it would be helpful to kind of explore what you mean by that before we delve into this particular story and how you have told it.
Yeah, and now I wonder if I shouldn't have put that maybe on the first page rather than in the notes. What I meant by that is when I started writing about the Ark of the Covenant, I realized at some point rather quickly that I was writing about the Ark of the Covenant, which is something that, you know, hasn't been seen in thousands of years. And if we're going to be honest about it, may have never been seen at all. You know, it just shows up in certain places in the Bible. So I realized that, you know, to tell a story about something where we don't know if it even exists, it was going to be really hard to do so in kind of the normal way of relying on the facts. So I realized that the only thing I could rely on were the people who were there. And luckily, most of the people who were there told their own stories about the expedition. So I thought, well, I can just present their stories and then they can kind of think about and wrestle with what they think really happened. And I really liked the way it turned out because, you know, that's what we kind of put with things like the Ark or things like faith or imagination, is we kind of have to take the facts with what we believe and kind of come out somewhere in the middle.
And you've tried to sort that out so nicely. How did you first become acquainted with this British gentleman by the name of Monty Parker and this expedition in 1909 that, at least to some extent, was done in secret? How did you first come across this?
I think it happened. I am unashamedly Raiders of the Lost Ark is my favorite movie of all time. and it's not that it's the best movie I've ever seen, but I think everybody has that one movie they see as a kid that really gets its hooks into them. And to me, it was absolutely Raiders. And it was something about that it was presented itself as so close to real life that it could almost be true. I mean, there's history, there's Nazis, there's these historical artifacts, and only at the end does it kind of jump into the supernatural. But I love that. And I always, you know, it's always stuck with me, and I think has kind of propelled my entire career, which is either both either really cool or maybe sad. But I was reading this book by Simon Montefiore, Jerusalem, and it's a terrific book. I'm sure many of your listeners have read. It's a biography of the city of Jerusalem. And he has this, like, page, half a page in there about the Parker expedition and about how they were looking for the Ark of the Covenant. I read this, and it felt like my face was melting off. Like the movie, because I couldn't believe of all the you know, the movies and stories and kind of pop culture stuff out there that Raiders would have some basis in reality. Not the Ark itself, but that someone had gone looking for it. And it took a long time and a lot of waiting and a lot of patience to find the story of Monty Parker, who's the scoundrel British nobleman who went after the Ark.
What do we know about the Ark of the Covenant? And is what we know about it found solely in Scripture? Or are there other mentions of the so-called Ark of the Covenant, which housed the remains of the tablets on which the Ten Commandments were inscribed? In terms of kind of the historical record, what do we know about any such Ark of the Covenant, in fact, existing at one time?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And the answer, which is kind of a cop, but I hope not, is it depends who you ask. Because I read a lot of these books about the history of the Ark, and I don't want to say fringe books, but some of them were. But I read them all because I wanted to respect what they had to say. It depends on who you ask, because some people say that you can find mentions of it in other places, other cultures. And I allude to that in the book, that other religions had these sort of big boxes that they would carry around, and people make correlations to the Ark, and some people see it in art. The way I approached it was I knew that the expedition itself would know it from the Bible. And there's lots of references to it in the Bible, and we have a lot of very specific references in the Bible. I mean, the Bible tells us how to build it, gives us measurements, tells us how to carry it. You know, King David makes the mistake of not carrying it the right way, and God strikes someone down who touches it right in the middle of the road. So it gives us very specific things, but at the same time, I knew that whoever was reading this, a large majority of the readers would know of it from Raiders of the Lost Ark. And in the beginning, I tried to avoid that because I said, well, I don't want to, you know, reference the movie. But I realized that was unavoidable, that when people think of the Ark, they think of that version. And the good thing that I find out is that version is very, very similar to the version that the expedition thought of. As I have a drawing in the book of what people envision the Ark of in the early 20th century, and it looks exactly like Spielberg's version. So I'm kind of drawing on a little bit of that, but the version he had is strictly from the Old Testament.
Hmm. This story actually begins a few decades ahead of 1909 and the specific expedition that was led by Monty Parker. Explain what the significance was of this earlier expedition to Jerusalem in 1867 by one Captain Charles Warren, and why your story, in a sense, needs to begin with this.
Yeah, so when Monty Parker goes, heads off to Jerusalem with his group, the shadowy syndicate, led by, or kind of guided by a Finnish mystic who has a mystical code and the whole thing, they're not archaeologists. They are strictly, I think, motivated by dollar signs. I should say pound signs. That they're going for fortune and glory, but also the immense wealth that finding something like the Ark would bring them. So then I find Charles Warren, who sometime earlier was going into the same tunnel that they end up going into. And he knew a bit more of the trade. He knew what he was doing a little bit. And he was motivated. He certainly was looking for artifacts and relics, but he was also really interested in what was going on underneath the tunnel. So I really like this idea of two different people going through the same tunnel separated by time, because that's what they're doing. They're going through this tunnel that may or may not have been used by King David, and they think was used to hide the Ark itself. So I wanted to show how the same place, different people going through it at different times can see different things and kind of build upon what the other sees. Because what Warren finds very early, he finds a lot of mystery, things that he can't explain. And I think that gets taken up by the Parker expedition, where they go directly after something physical like the Ark.
Hmm. This is as good a time as any to just try to get from you some broader context in terms of the presence of the British, and for that matter, other Westerners in the Middle East at this point in time, and just how much was going on in the way of exploration, expeditions, which so easily could lead into what others would regard as sort of heartless, selfish plundering. How much of that are we seeing in this era, and how much does this fold into that?
Yeah, it's a great question. That's the title, is Raiders. I mean, the kind of definition of a raider is someone that comes in and takes something. And though it's highly romanticized, both by themselves, I think, and by me, a little bit, that, oh, we're going to go up to Jerusalem. And someone remarked me that this is a very British thing to do, that someone says, hey, the Ark's in Jerusalem, and boom, they're just headed for the horizon. But there is that element of Jerusalem at this time is controlled by the Turks, by the Ottomans, but there's always that tension between the different religions that is kind of the linchpin of the city throughout history. And there are times during, you know, while we're there for the Parker expedition, that this explodes into violence. But there's always this sense of wanting to step on someone else's toes, and there's permits to be had, and there are bribes to be given. So it's a very political atmosphere. But absolutely, you know, there in the beginning to find the Ark and bring it home. When they start digging just outside of Jerusalem, they tell all the local people that, oh, we are a construction group. We are going to build a school and a hospital. And they have absolutely no intention of doing otherwise. So they start out as fairly bad people, I would say. I think that changes over time, which is one of the main reasons I was interested in the story. But they start out that way, and certainly Warren's adventures too, which kind of happen in flashback in the book. There's one in particular where he goes after a stone that all of these different people are trying to get just to take home and put in their museum. So So that becomes a noble thing to put something in a museum. Then there's the thing that you refer to. It's stealing from the country it's from to put it in your own museum.
We're speaking with Brad Ritka, and we're talking about his newest book, which is called True Raiders, the untold story of the 1909 expedition to find the legendary Ark of the Covenant. The book chronicles what indeed was an expedition to Jerusalem that began in 1909, an expedition carried out, at least to some extent, in secret, with a really amazing array of different characters who are part of this. And they are indeed in search of the fabled Ark of the Covenant. After we first hear about this earlier expedition in the 1860s, then we hear about further developments in this section of the book, which is collectively titled The Cipher, C-I-P-H-E-R. And it's really important for us to, first of all, understand this term as you are using it, and then how this term relates to this amazing story to follow.
So a cipher is a code. And it, at this point in history, in England especially, the early turn of the into the 20th century, and even before, it was something that people knew about. I mean, there were theories that you could read Shakespeare with a code. You could read some of the other playwrights and then reveal that they were the real Shakespeare. And, of course, countless religious iterations of this, that you could find secret messages in the Bible. For our story, it starts with, I referenced him before, a Finnish scholar whose name was Dr. Walter Juvelius. And he found, or claimed to have found, a cipher in the Old Testament, mostly in the book of Ezekiel, that he claimed led him to where the Ark of the Covenant was in Jerusalem. And he had been influenced by a couple other people who were doing similar things, biblical, looking for biblical artifacts was really popular at the time, because people had this sense that the Bible was real, and therefore we can go get the things that it talks about. And his cipher is very complicated, and it's very detailed, and I go through it in the book so that people can try it if they want to. It involves every seventh letter, and then you loop something around, and he shows this to the syndicate of British businessmen and ex-soldiers, and to Monty, too. And the remarkable thing is it sounds ludicrous, right? The hidden code, the secret code in the Bible. But he starts doing it, and sentences appear. And not just any sentences, but they're saying, go 40 yards this way, and I mean, it's a different measurement, but and turn right and look for the burning flame. And you get the sense that in this room, huddled around this table, looking at these maps that this guy has drawn out, that chills are going up their spine, that perhaps this is real. Could this be real? Well, they're seeing the sentence right there. So I think it's a major part of the book, but also I think it's a major part of what I'm trying to explore with it is what do you believe? You know, where do you put your truth? Is it in the facts of the words? Or is it in a belief that they're leading someplace else? Because these guys see the cipher, and they go raise a lot of money and just head off to Jerusalem. So they believe it.
I mean, one way to phrase it is they fell for it, hook, line, and sinker. I mean, that phrasing it that way assumes that this could not possibly be true, that this was kind of a fanciful fabrication of one kind or another. But I mean, whether or not it's true, I mean, they absolutely believed it was true to the extent of being able to risk life and limb and devote tremendous resources and so on, and perhaps in some ways risk their own reputations in pursuit of this. How much do we know about this Dr. Gevelius, and what was prompting him to do this and how he went about doing this. What kind of a legacy did he leave behind him that would help us understand how he could construct such a thing?
Yeah, he's just, to me, endlessly fascinating because he's this scholar. He's kind of sickly. It seems he has a kind of terrific drinking problem. He has a family. And at one point in his life, he's a surveyor. And being a surveyor, he walks the countryside and spends the night in these like odd cabins. And here he finds a Bible. And he's a poet before this, too, and a good poet, too. People still read his stuff there. And he reads this Bible, and he becomes obsessed with the idea of biblical history, meaning, you know, does the history in the Bible, is it supposed to be read literally, or is it metaphor? Is it a metaphor? Do we read it metaphorically? And he thinks he's figured out how to do it literally, and he, you know, really devotes his days and nights to this. He ends up getting a PhD. What I found was really, and any grad students listening will really love this. In Finland, if you get a PhD, they give you a sword, which I didn't know. I thought that was kind of interesting. So he gets his sword, and he works on this theory, and he's being influenced from people he knows too. I think he's motivated by spiritual concerns, but it just seems like this is his thing. This is his great crossword puzzle that he just constantly worries over. And when he goes to Jerusalem, he's always modifying and tinkering with the cipher. And like you said, they fall for it. They believe in it. But as soon as things start to go wrong and, you know, maybe it says go left and there's a solid rock wall, then they start to question it. They say, well, you know, let's go back and look at this. You know, their faith only goes so far. But I think he's really into it just to solve it. And if I'm kind of clunking over my words, it's because I don't really know how to pin him down, because near the end of the book, he becomes one of the narrators of the book, and he really relates some very strange adventures that he says are true. I don't know if they're true. I'm presenting them as he did. They're certainly surreal. So to me, he's one of the, like you said, one of the fascinating characters in
them. Right. And of course, one of the things that this story kind of relates to us and we can probably relate to it is when there is something that is so amazing that we desperately want it to be true. And a little later in this chapter, when by this point Monty Parker is sort of on board with the possibility of leading this expedition to Jerusalem to follow the guidance of this cipher that Dr. Gevelius has supposedly found, you write this: there was a moment, or perhaps a great many of them, that slowly blended into one, where Monty either began to believe in what he was being told, or perhaps more likely, wanted to believe what it might get him. And, I mean, it's really kind of intriguing to think about perfectly intelligent people, in a sense, kind of being caught up in the magic of such a possibility that the Ark of the Covenant not only might still exist, but that we might be able to pin down exactly where it is located and perhaps even find it and look at it with our own eyes. I mean, it's probably all of us kind of reading this might be left to wonder, you know, how would we react to a similar kind of possibility?
Yeah, and I'm so glad you picked that sentence out. That's really, I think, that was the book for me. I mean, I wrote it because I love Raiders of the Lost Ark, and I love this stuff. But that was it. I mean, because I wrote this a large part during the pandemic, and there's the good side of that passage where that's just magic. That's the film. That's all these kind of speculative topics like the Ark or Bigfoot or the Bermuda Triangle. And I grew up on this stuff. And the part where you just can suspend your doubt just a little bit, and it becomes this magical moment. But there's a dark side of that too, where you can fall for things and believe in things that simply aren't true, and you go too far and you can't come back.
We're speaking with Brad Ricca, author of True Raiders, the untold story of the 1909 expedition to find the legendary Ark of the Covenant. Do you have time for a few more questions?
Sure.
So this story is also, to a lesser extent, about the English and English society at this point in time. And one of the really interesting people that we meet is a beautiful and wealthy woman by the name of Ava Lowell Willing Astor, of the famous Astor family, and someone who crosses paths with Monty Parker at one point in time. And as you are discussing her and his interest in her and the way in which this expedition might sort of catch her attention and impress her, you write these intriguing words: English society was, as always, a labyrinth of guessing and aim. I just love that turn of phrase. Tell us more about English society at this point in time and people like Monty Parker and Ava Astor, how they were trying to navigate their way through this world, which was a labyrinth of guessing and aim.
Yeah, I think that passage refers to me as well. When I started this, trying to understand that entire kind of subset of society, I wrote, Monty's father was an earl, and he was the second son, so he didn't inherit, when his father died, he didn't inherit the estate, this beautiful estate. In England, Saltram. So he's kind of, he had this, he had status in the community, but he didn't have the status just because of his birth. So it's kind of a shadow of the royal questions and issues that go on with there. So he becomes a soldier. So he meets Ava, and she is considered the greatest catch of the age in the newspapers. She's recently divorced, and she's extraordinarily wealthy. And she's living in London, and the newspapers say she's the most beautiful woman in the world. And all these gossip columnists are saying, well, she's talking a lot with Montague Parker in these shadowy corners of the room and so forth. So she would have been, for him, a really great, and I hate this kind of the English terminology for it back then, a really great prospect because of her money and her wealth, and this could propel him even higher. But there's this story, that, he's thinking about going for the Ark, and she kind of dumps him because she has all these other suitors who have much more to their name, and their accomplishments are mighty. And he tells her, well, I'm thinking about going to find the Ark of the Covenant. And she pauses for a moment. And it's this great pause because you don't know if she thinks he has completely lost his mind or is, again, this goes back to that other point, is there just a glimmer or a possibility that this is true? And she says, okay, if you bring me back the Ark of the Covenant, we'll talk again. So it becomes one of those on the long checklist of kind of dumb and at the same time really daring things that people do for love. It finds its way on there as well. But she becomes kind of part of a parallel storyline as to what happens with her. But that part of society is very interesting. I wrote the current Earl of Morley. Monty's father was the Earl of Morley, and he becomes later. And I didn't even know how to address him. And, you know, I looked up in the peerage books, and I think it was Sir Lord of Morley, and I finally talked to him later on Zoom, and I addressed him in the full, and he said, you know, please call me Mark. So thankfully, some of the old stuff hasn't stuck around.
Right. And we should mention, and you kind of spell this out towards the very, very, very end of the book, that that thanks to that connection that you were able to make with one of the descendants of Monty Parker, you were able to gain direct access to his archives. And it's from that that you draw some of the richest information in order to write this book.
Yeah, I mean, the story is only, especially a story like this about something like the Ark, to go back to, you know, your first question, it's only as good as the facts you can find. And I was really lucky that the archives of Monty Parker, which are the archives of the expedition, all the letters, all the expense reports, and the cipher itself, which was the real kind of gold mine for me, were finally found after a long, many decades of not knowing who had them or where they were, even if they existed. They were kind of like the Ark itself. Hmm. And they helped enormously to at least give his voice, make his voice a little stronger, because I have a lot of other people that were there and wrote and said stuff, but Monty never did. He was very quiet about it. But once I got to see these, I got to see where he fit in a little better.
One thing we've not talked about yet is the city of Jerusalem, which is, of course, primarily where this expedition focuses its efforts, with the belief that the Ark of the Covenant is housed there in some of the underground tunnels there. As you describe the arrival of Monty Parker and others in his party to Jerusalem, you describe the city this way. When Monty passed through the gates into Jerusalem, his hat was over his eyes and he wore a scarf over his mouth with his pipe sticking out. The interior of the city was filled with tiny staircases and narrow streets. Monty saw merchants and pilgrims, Jews and Christians. The Arabs ran to prayers in their flowing robes. Ottoman Turks in their trim suits walked by on streets that seemed to wind in on themselves in a never-ending rolling labyrinth. It was a shared city, but the differences were plain to any eyes. The city was romantic and ancient. That much could be felt in the air. But it was also crowded, noisy, and exceedingly filthy. It smelled of warm bread, thick incense, wisteria, and rot. It's a really intriguing description, and it's almost like we are there. What more do you want to say about the city of Jerusalem at this point in its history?
Just that I'm thankful, because I have never been to Jerusalem. I was going to go for this, but then all, you know, this stuff happened. That I'm really grateful for. Jerusalem was, as it is now, a place for many pilgrims to go, and pilgrims from English-speaking countries went there and kept journals and diaries and took photographs. And that's what I read, and they're so wonderful, and looked at to build that picture up, because I needed that to be really right on. And that's what they all say. They say it's, you can see the difference. And in one hand, it was so beautiful. On the other hand, it was just so dirty. And this is something the English say constantly. And I think that's very telling on them, too. I think Jerusalem is, you know, I know so much more about it now, having written this book. I hope to someday, can't wait to go there. It's own kind of organism, really, that everything is, but it's kind of like a symbiosis, that everything is kind of moving around inside it, and people go to one side and then go to the other side, and people who are in control, that shifts around, but the city doesn't move. The city is always the same. And that's just so intriguing to me. And in some ways, just so sad, too, because there's so much conflict. And so when parts of it are destroyed or ruined, you know, that's it doesn't come back.
Right. And, of course, it has a storied history that includes falling more than once. And, of course,
yeah.
If there ever was an actual physical Ark of the Covenant, you know, the question is, was it carried off or is it still there? Was it carried off but brought back and so on? The mystery just sort of deepens.
Yeah.
We haven't yet touched on the matter of this interesting array of people who were part of this expedition. We don't have time to go into limitless details on all of them, but at least sketch for our listeners kind of the interesting array of people who are part of this effort. It really feels like something from a movie. I mean, the way that Hollywood would, you know, create a fictional expedition, except this actually happened.
Yeah, it's kind of like the Dirty Dozen a little bit. There's Juvelius, of course, and Monty Parker, and like I said, they're not archaeologists at all, so they eventually have to get somebody in, and this is Sir Vincent, who's this French priest who lives in Jerusalem, who is an archaeologist, and he lives for it, and it's his passion, and his chapters are really the kind of the science of it, and he's just wonderful. I think my favorite character is Cyril. He's an ex-soldier, and a British ex-soldier, and he kind of finds himself in all sorts of trouble. And he always gets out of it, and he's always laughing throughout. He was a professional cricket player. I had to write a description of a cricket match, which was really, really difficult. But he's great. He goes into caves and gets knocked around by bats and all sorts of things. There really is, and there's Juvelius and he has a friend. There's certain people around the outside that may or may not be traitors or spies. And there are people trying to creep in on the expedition from the side. There's a lot going on. There's a lot of people, but I'm glad because that makes it more than just one person. Oh, I caught this giant trout, and it was this big. I threw it back, so you'll just have to believe me. So here we have a lot of different people talking about the trout that they may or may not have caught, and then the reader can kind of figure out on their own.
Right. And of course, this is an expedition in which nobody involved in it wants anybody from the outside to know what they are looking for. And for a lot of different reasons, it was important that this expedition be done in secret. I mean, with its true purpose very much veiled to any outsiders.
Absolutely. And they're always pushing away people who are nosing in and the press and so forth. And at the end, when everything kind of blows up, it's so just shocking to see the headlines all over the world. On the front page of the Times, it's "Have Englishmen Found the Ark," with a picture of Jerusalem. And so even the press is taking this seriously. So they were right to kind of keep them away as long as they did.
Right. I think it's important for us to understand this underground, and we're using that term very literally, the underground that they were primarily exploring, at least at the outset, about, you know, why these tunnels and caves were there. And at one point you have this really intriguing description as you're kind of trying to help us understand the sort of sense of mystery that these men were feeling as they were exploring some of these dark caverns. You write at one point, "Though the caves were natural, someone had molded and connected them to a higher purpose." So were these tunnels, were these caves, were they both? And what do we know about their purpose and why they were created in the first place?
Yeah. So again, it's kind of depends who you ask. I made very sure to kind of end this book back in the past a little, and I was going to talk about what they think about it now, but archaeologists today still disagree about what parts of the tunnel are natural and what parts are man-made and what it was used for.
Wow.
Even though if you go there, if you go there now, it's called Hezekiah's Tunnel, and you can go and walk through it as a tourist. You have to take your shoes off because there's some water, and it's supposedly just a really wonderful experience unless you have claustrophobia. So the story is that it is Hezekiah's Tunnel, which is from the Old Testament, used by David to sneak up behind his enemies and wipe them out. And then the expedition, part of their theory is that this was also the tunnel used to secret away the Ark from the Babylonians, which, as you referenced before, nobody knows really what happens after they sacked Jerusalem. There's parts of it you see, I think, that are clearly man-made, and Father Vincent goes into this, but there are parts that are natural too, and I think that's part of the bigger question. I don't want to say they didn't find the Ark, but if you found, the Ark in your backyard by some miracle of everything, you would say, was this made by man, or was this made by something else? It's different than a cave, but I think the question is the same as to what are the forces around me that are shaping things into what I'm looking at right now.
Right. And if you come across a little natural spring, well, is this the fabled
right.
such and such? And are these stairs over here the fabled such and such? Are they just stairs? And yes,
right. Yeah.
Through what eyes are reviewing these things?
Yeah, it's all like the great, all of a sudden throughout the Middle Ages, everyone had a piece of the true cross. Everyone saw a splinter on the ground and said, "Oh, it's the true cross." So yeah, it's the same thing.
It's this hunger that at least many people have had for a taste of the tangible when there is this something that is so incredibly important to you, and to be able to hold something in your hand or be able to touch something that is actually physically, tangibly part of that story is just an irresistible urge. Ultimately, your book chronicles this amazing expeditions and the tantalizing, promising steps and the frustrations and the dead ends and so on. Ultimately, the expedition, in a sense, kind of dissolves under a cloud of terrible controversy. Just briefly summarize what I'm talking about.
So they kind of run out of money. It's the rainy season, and everything's, they've mapped out the tunnel, and the cipher is kind of, Jubelius has left, the cipher has been kind of exhausted, and everything kind of revolves around the Dome of the Rock, which is up on the hill inside the city of Jerusalem. And Mani gets it in his head, he reads the cipher a certain way, that the Ark is underneath the dome. But of course they can't dig there. It's expressly forbidden. It's one of the holiest sites in Jerusalem. It is to this day, to all the three religions. And it just the same as the movie, really, as Raiders. Monty decides, okay, we're going to put on disguises and we're going to go up there and we're going to bluff our way in and bribe our way in and just start digging. And that's what they do, which is, like I said, it's just out of the movie. And they dig under the dome and it causes a riot. And this is where the newspaper headlines spring up raiders have attacked Jerusalem. Have the Englishmen gotten away with the Ark? And the story just spirals into not only do they get the Ark, they get the Ten Commandments, they get all these other religious artifacts. And the expedition's gone. They've taken off on their yacht because, of course, they take a yacht to Palestine. But the question, and it's a great controversy and a great uproar. And people go to jail. People are sentenced to die. But you know, without giving too much away, there's real mystery at the end as to what happened. And I try to tell what different people say. And I found a letter from Monty where he details what happened. And I try to leave it to the reader of the question of, did they find the Ark? Did they find something? Where is it? Or even what could it be?
Mm. Yes. And I like the way you handle that very, very much. So, can we assume, I mean, you really imply this in your book, that fabled movie, Raiders of the Lost Ark, is very much directly inspired by at least aspects of this story?
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't say for sure because, that opens a lot of boxes that, you know, and I don't know what they were thinking, but I was able to trace a line through a dentist's office of all places, and it's small in the book. It's just the last page, but I really like it because to me it's not. I mean, there's definitely details in the Parker expedition, the Well of Souls, the lots of things that show up in the film. I don't know how they got there, but they definitely do. But to me, it's more that what begins as facts becomes this kind of mythic story that this dentist tells to this kid who's going to be a movie producer when he grows up. And that's really what I wanted to explore in this, is how do facts become a story? And then once we have that story, what do we do with it? Do we believe in the story? Do we believe in the facts? Or is it something altogether?
Hmm. Well, we're left to ponder a lot of things after reading your wonderful and entertaining book, which again is titled True Raiders, the Untold Story of the 1909 Expedition to Find the Legendary Ark of the Covenant, published by St. Martin's Press and the author, Brad Ricca. Brad Ricca, thank you for giving the world yet another fascinating book, and thank you for being part of the morning show today.
Thank you so much, Greg. It was great.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, I am excited to welcome back to the program Dr. John Swallow, who is the president of Carthage College. We are having Dr. Swallow on just ahead of homecoming at Carthage. And of course, homecoming will look a little bit different than it did last year, still impacted by COVID-19, but plenty of festivities nonetheless. And we'll be talking with him about that and other matters related to the state of the college. On Wednesday, it's Nan Calvert's monthly visit to the program. We're going to be getting an update on the massive Pike River Restoration Project. Joining her will be Dave Giordano from Root Pike Wynn and Jim Cruiser, who is the Kenosha County Executive. And Thursday on the morning show, we are scheduled to be hearing from the Executive Director and CEO of the National Wildlife Federation, Colin O'Mara. And we also will be getting an update on the most recent theatrical production at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived on our website, WGTD.org, and it is also available as a podcast 7 days a week. This past weekend, we had out of the archives two interesting interviews. One of them, the very first interview conducted over WGTD with David Beth when he was first elected Kenosha County Sheriff. Also a conversation with Obi Yadgar about his book, Will's